Welcome to the first Formula E Zone podcast of season 5. The Gen 2 cars are here, the 2019 season is here, and of course, a brand new podcast for you guys, the listeners at home, lovers of Formula E, or even if you're new to Formula E, hopefully this podcast will give you a bit of an insight into the world of Formula E. Links will be in the description. If you're watching on YouTube, straight over to the Formula E Zone website where you can get all the latest and greatest Formula E news. But first things first, you've probably got a few questions about the Formula E Zone podcast. First of all, this is going to be a, for the moment, race reviews after each race of the Formula E Season 5 season, and then we'll take it from there. So it's very early stages at the moment, so any feedback would be brilliant if you could put that in the comments below or send us a message on Twitter. Also, probably the more important bit, who are you going to be listening to? So, obviously, me. I am one of the main people over on this podcast. My name is Dan, if you're not aware. Some of you might be watching this very podcast from my own YouTube channel. I do run my own YouTube channel based around Formula E. I really do love Formula E. And you know what? I've always struggled to pick a favourite driver, but over the past few years, Jaguar have really seemed to be the team that are sticking out for me, especially Mitch Evans. But obviously, I imagine as a lot of new fans will, I'm a big fan of Stoffel Vandoorne and Pascal Wehrlein. And today we're going to be doing our race rundown for the Marrakech E-Prix. Now, I'm not going to be doing this podcast just by myself. I'm also going to be joined by Jack and Tobias, and I'd like to know a little bit more about you guys, and I'm sure all our listeners will as well. So, Jack, welcome to the podcast. Let the viewers know who you are.
Hello, I'm Jack George Maynard, obviously part of Formula E Zone since day one. Been following Formula E ever since back of May 2014 when I first heard of it and the cars were released back in Donington. And yeah, and I've, you know, we've been to races, we've done quite a lot on Formula E Zone, so yeah, I'm sure most people might know me.
So hopefully you got a pretty good insight into the world of Formula E. That's good to know, that's a good start. And we're also joined by Tobias. Hello, Tobias.
Hello, Dan, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. I'm feeling really positive today. Tell us about your Formula E journey.
Oh, wow. I mean, I've been part of Formula E Zone since day two. I've been following Formula E for an eternity as well. Not as long as Jack has, but for a significant amount of time. Even, I mean, let's just say since the first race. And I am obviously from Germany, as you might hear. And I'm joining this podcast now. What else is there to say? Nothing major apart from that, really. Yeah. So that's me. I'm Toby.
That's fair enough.
Fair enough.
Yep, that's fair enough. Who's your favourite driver, Toby? That's what I really want to know. I'll ask you in a second, Jack.
So many.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
I really liked Felix Rosenqvist, but he's out of the series now. From a driving perspective, maybe Mitch Evans. He's a good driver. And from on a more personal level, I really do enjoy talking to Max Günther. Obviously, the German.
Oh, okay. I did not expect that.
He's a really, really cool dude. I mean, I'm used to doing podcasts in German, and we're already at episode 100. I mean, we're now in episode 1, but I'm talking about episode 100. But in episode 100 of my German podcast, we had him on as a special guest, and we were literally talking for 2 hours straight. And he was laughing with us, had a great time, and he's a really, really cool dude.
That's good to know, actually, because he's not had the best start to the season, has he?
Jack,
who's your favourite driver?
Oh, I don't know if I have a favourite, but I really enjoy talking. I think it's the same as Tobias. There's drivers that you get along with when you talk to, so I really get along with Daniel Abt. I think there's an age similarity there. So, you know, we're able to talk just, you know, naturally, I think, because we're about the same age. I enjoy talking to Sam. Sam's quite very honest, Sam Bird. And Oliver Turvey. Oliver Turvey's also another really nice person to talk to and, you know, easy to talk to. And that makes things so much easier as a journalist.
And a good driver too, yeah.
I'm not as lucky as you guys, so I don't get to fly out to all these countries. But we'll see over the next few seasons. Right, so we're not going to be talking about our favourite drivers for this whole podcast, and we're here to talk about the Marrakech E-Prix. But first, I just want to have a little look back at the first race of the season, because obviously we didn't have time to do a podcast. So I want to hear your guys' first thoughts of the first race of the season. I'll quickly just say mine. And for the first round of the season, it wasn't a Formula E classic. I would say it was a great win from BMW and DaCosta, and they've really shown that their pace from testing is real. And also the cheetah cars in that first race really looked like the team to beat. But I'll come to you first, Tobias. What did you take away from that first round of the season?
First of all, obviously, rain. It never rained in Formula E before, and that was a first. So mad, mad day with all the rain coming down. And then, just like you, BMW and DS to cheetah literally being level on performance. Maybe DS with a bit of an advantage. And it was really interesting to follow the Adiria Ypres, and really interesting to see how well BMW started into their Formula E journey as a works entry.
Yes, that's a good point that you mentioned the rain. Jack, I think that was something that you wanted to talk about, wasn't it?
Yeah, the conditions obviously had a major impact on having practice one and practice two essentially called off, and then, you know, that last minute practice session just before quali, and everything was just up in the air, and it just never felt like a Formula E race. Well, obviously it did because there was a Formula E race, but the build up to a Formula E race just was so quick and didn't feel like it was there. So that's why I think there was a bit of a strange result, and a lot of teams came out of that race weekend saying, okay, Marrakesh will probably be a true representation, and it possibly was, and we'll get onto that in a second. But yeah, I think the weather conditions played a part. And Tobias, just to correct you, yeah, London, it did rain in quali, remember.
Yeah.
So we have seen rain before, but not in a
drizzle.
Race. And we still didn't see, a bit of rain in the race,
I would say,
in Saudi
true.
Arabia.
We had a wet shakedown in New York last year, I think.
Of course,
and
yeah.
The year before.
We have seen rain
before. We've seen rain before, but not sorts of rainfalls. And kind of just that to my earlier point, of course, it was the first race of the second Formula E generation, wasn't it? So apart from, of course, being a great event and being the start of a new season, it was also the start of a new era for Formula E.
And I think, obviously, it went really well. Like, the Gen 2 cars, you know, let's think back to 2014 Beijing April when Alejandro Agag was like, I didn't even know the cars were going to get off the line. I suppose maybe for him that was something similar. Like, it was a whole new concept, new car, obviously been tested. Like, the Season 1 cars were tested. And they got off the line and they produced a good show, and the race product produced a good show. And obviously, we'll talk a little bit more about the effects of the new regulations that they've brought in. But the show that they brought on actually was quite good. And I think Saudi Arabia proved that Formula E has probably made the right decisions and can still develop and can still move forward.
Oh, it's an incredible looking car. And I know me and you, Jack, got to go to Autosport over the weekend and just seeing it in the flesh as well. I know it wasn't the actual one, but it is truly an incredible car. And I don't want to talk about Formula One really too much on this podcast, but if they can get something like that in the future, that would be nice to see over there. But for sure, the Gen 2 car is something really special. But let's move on then to this weekend. And qualifying is where we started off. And starting the weekend in practice, it looked like the Virgin cars might actually have some pace. And, well, before we get into the final result of qualifying, we had a spicy little incident in Parc Fermé in the pit lane. Jack, do you want to go through that one? Because that was quite interesting.
Yeah, it was a bit odd. You don't normally see a pit lane crash like that. But apparently Tom Dillman hit the back of Fiennes, which then caused Fiennes to hit the back of Sam Bird, damaging both the Virgin cars' diffuser in the process. Fiennes more heavily than Sam's. But Dillman said that he completely lost brakes, and in his post-race interview said it was better that he hit the car than he hit a marshal. So it's odd that he had a braking failure, but, you know, these things can happen. It is motorsport, but it was bizarre.
They shouldn't happen, these things. He had a problem with a brake-by-wire, obviously another new technicality in Formula E. Previously, brake-by-wire systems were forbidden by the regulations. Now they're allowed. And he had a brake-by-wire problem in FP2 and then ended up piling into the Virgins. Well, now they're no longer Virgins, aren't they? In qualifying. I don't know if that's related to the brake-by-wire incident from FP2.
And we also have to think, but Eduardo Mortara in Saudi Arabia also had similar brake-by-wire issues, and obviously caused him to, in practice and qualifying, and in the race, which caused his retirement. So maybe there might be something that they might have to look at in the brake-by-wire era.
And what the incident meant is that, of course, with the Parc Fermé regulations being in place, Sam Burt had to start into the Super Bowl qualifying shootout with a slightly damaged diffuser, which surely made things more difficult for him.
Yeah, exactly. But as we all know, he was able to push through those difficulties and somehow, with an incredible lap, was able to stick it on pole. I mean, I didn't see that coming. It was Jon-Erik Vern in second. And then, I know, Tobias, you seem to know about this incident in a fair bit of detail, so I'll come to you. Antonio Felix da Costa getting a three-place grid penalty. What was that all about?
Yeah, so what happened? He initially qualified in P3 and then got penalised by the stewards after qualifying. Thing is, usually in Formula E, you're supposed to be doing an outlap, set a banker lap, switch the electric motor up to 250 kilowatts, which is the qualifying output, and then do your lap, and then an in-lap. What Felix da Costa did was do the outlap and switch the motor straight to 250 kilowatts, without setting his banker lap time, obviously. And in doing so, he overused power, because on your outlap you're only allowed to be doing 200 kilowatts, and he was clocked, I think, using 204 kilowatts, so not that much of a difference. But still, he overused power on his outlap, didn't do a banker lap, and his initial lap time would have brought him P3, but he was penalised with a three-place grid drop, and that meant he had to start the race from P6.
It was just such a strange incident. I mean, I'm not going to lie, I was surprised that anything like that was going to happen this year in Formula E. I thought they were really going to, well, most of the drivers, iron out a lot of these issues. But I think, I'll ask you, Jack, I mean, how did you see this incident? Were you thinking it's a little bit bizarre?
No, I don't think it's bizarre. I think it can still happen. You have to remember this is still a street track. There are still bumps. And that's the problem at the moment, is when the cars skid across bumps.
It was very bumpy, this circuit, wasn't it, as well?
It still was bumpy, but there are bumpier circuits out there. But, I mean, he still might have been, riding over a curb. There were these sausage curbs in turns 4 and 5, the chicane. He might have overused his, crossed this 200 kilowatts benchmark while riding these curbs. I don't know.
Well, I suppose disappointing one for Felix da Costa, but it did mean that Buemi in the Nissan was able to get third on the grid, which I was surprised at the Nissan's pace, but I think we'll move on then to lap one. And already this was looking, just after qualifying in practice, it was starting to look like a proper Formula E weekend. And, well, we were treated into the first corner, weren't we? Jon-Erik Vern, I mean, I'll say my thoughts there first. I'm going to say that was a bit of a rookie mistake from Vern. I really do believe that. I think that was Bird's corner all day long. It didn't seem like Vern locked up or anything like that. It really just looked like he was just trying to just go for a move, which I think's so rash considering the pace of that Tochita car that we'd seen. But there was a huge concertina effect of Vern ended up spinning round, going to the back of the grid. Then we saw the two Jaguars being pushed wide. We saw the two Nissan cars being pushed wide, and we saw some big smashes a little bit further back with the two HWA cars and Lucas Degrassi smacking into the back of Pascal Wehrlein, who was in his first outing for Mahindra. So, Jack, how do you see this incident?
Vern and Bird. With Vern, he said after the race, which I thought was quite funny, he used the Ayrton Senna school of tricks, saying, "No, I'm a racing driver, I went for a gap." He saw a gap and then he realised very quickly that gap wasn't there. And so he backed out of it. But obviously, that causing that back out cost Buemi massively, obviously cost himself massively, because I feel if he had not done that, he would have won this race by a country mile. So it was had a major impact for Vern, because he would have won, in my opinion.
I agree. Mm.
Yeah, but I agree as well.
To me, it seemed like Vern just forgot about his braking point. He had a terrible, terrible getaway off the line and was under pressure from Buemi behind, and he was coming closer and closer and closer. And I think maybe Vern just wanted to defend from Buemi, not even attack Sam Bird, but maybe just defend from the guys behind, and then, forgot about his braking point and pile-drived into Sam.
To be honest, it's an uncharacteristic... Sorry. It was an uncharacteristic mistake from Verne. Like, we haven't seen that from him in ages. He's been super consistent, and that's why he won his championship. And it just felt like, well, I wouldn't call it a rookie move, because you see it quite, you can sometimes see it quite often, but it's just like that thought of you don't win the race in the first lap sort of went, you know, didn't go through his mind at that point, because I reckon he had the pace to overtake Bird, you know, within the, by the end of the lap, but even going into the first five laps of the race, he would have had the pace. He just needed to be a bit more patient. But, you know, at the end of the day, he is the professional racer.
No, right? Yeah, I agree with you as well. I mean, I know we're going to talk about it a little bit later on, but where he eventually finished, the same as Andre Lotterer, who started at the back of the grid. Yeah, I think you're right. I think they definitely would have had the pace to at least fight for the win. But yeah, I think he would have probably been the favourite, looking at that Virgin's pace during the race. But another point that I want to pick up on that first lap was Pascal Wehrlein, someone who has had a lot of hype going into this.
Mm-hmm.
Two seasons in Formula One, ex-Mercedes young driver, seventh on the grid, which I think was a really good effort for his first ever qualifying. Out-qualified Jerome D'Ambrosio, and then, unfortunately, out on lap one. Straddled the curb halfway through the lap, and I don't know if either of you two know the exact reason for him not finishing, but we saw from the, well, images from the garage, he was definitely not a happy bunny with the incident. So, Tobias, how do you see Wehrlein's first race? Because I'm sure he's going to be gutted.
Oh yeah, he was livid after he was being taken out, basically, by Lucas Degrassi. He had a really good outing in the mornings, of course. He showed promising pace on the long runs in the two free practice sessions. Had a good qualifying, as you said, out-qualifying his teammate. And then it looked as if Degrassi just did the same mistake Verne did, not braking. And he piled into the rear end of him. Pascal later said to me that he had a broken diffuser, rear axle, suspension, everything that could go kaput on the rear of a race car did go kaput. No, it didn't. No, and then he had, of course, his time together with a curb in turn five. That didn't help things, surely, and after the end of lap one, he entered the pits and had to retire the car. Which is obviously really sad for him, because he was promising, as I said earlier. He had a promising morning, and obviously with the Mahindra showing some good performance and pace in the race as well. We're going to touch on that a bit later, I'm sure. He could have ended up, well, top five possibly. I mean, let's just say top 10, but possibly even top five.
But what I wanted to just say quickly is, obviously, Wehrlein and Van Dorn were the two drivers, obviously, that were big name ex-Formula One drivers coming into the series, and there was a lot of interest about those two drivers, and both of them haven't got off. Obviously, Wehrlein missed Saudi Arabia, you know, not his fault. But, you know, you could tell that he was a driver looking forward to that first race, and to be taken out in the way he was awful for him. And then, obviously, we'll move on to, like, Stoffel Van Dorn, who, again, retired from the race, and, you know, it just hasn't started well for him.
Yeah, he was.
Well, you can continue with that if you'd like about the HWA boys, because they've really had a difficult start. And I'm not too surprised. I think a lot of people, there was this sort of hype train with Van Dorn and HWA, everyone thinking that, oh, this Mercedes-esque team are going to be fighting at the front. And I think a lot of new fans to Formula E, this was a big shock to the system for them that Van Dorn's at the back of the grid again. So, yeah, I another disappointing day. But continue, Jack, because I think you were leading on to something there.
No, I don't think it's disappointing. You have to remember, Jaguar, when they came in season three, I believe, was it season three?
Yes, I think yes. So, yeah.
Yes, right, thank you. Yeah, I just had a brain moment.
That's
there.
All right.
But yeah, they came in season three, and they knew straight away that they were going to struggle. They knew they weren't. And it was going to be the same with HWA. It's a new team, okay? New powertrain. I have the Venturi powertrain as well, which might also be a bit of a hindrance to them, because at the moment, Venturi aren't even performing very well, so we don't know how good that powertrain is, okay? So that you always have to contend with. And also, when you're qualifying and you're new and you're at the back of the grid and it's a 22-car grid now, the cars are a bit wider, you know, first lap incidences on much tighter tracks than Marrakesh are going to be more frequent. So if you're in that back of the pack, things like that could happen much easier than we see in other motorsport series.
And it certainly doesn't help if they take each other out, which was the case in Marrakesh. I think we had these three separate incidents. In turn one, maybe Verne kickstarted it all, but fact is, we had these three incidents with, well, Verne spinning, that's the first one. Second one, Degrassi and Verline. Third one, both HWO drivers taking each other out. Gary Paffett later retired with damage to his left rear tire, had a slow puncture, and I think Van Dorn just had general damage to his suspension, retired after lap one. So them taking each other out doesn't really help things if you want to advance in a championship. And
but at the end of the day, we don't know what's going to happen with HWA. Well, what is expected to happen is the day will just turn into the Mercedes factory team.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Okay, so in essence, really, this season's just a learning year. Even if they score no points, it doesn't even matter if they score no points because they'll still get the funding from Mercedes. So like, it's not like they're not going to get any prize money. You know, there's going to be Mercedes factory power. So it's just a learning year for HWA, essentially.
Yeah, and I think I'd like to know what you two think about this as well, because everyone's saying that Van Dorn, oh, he's one of the best drivers on the grid. But I remember when John Eric Verne came to Formula E and he put it on pole in that first race. And everyone was like, yes, he's going to be world champion straight away. And it took him four seasons. I see it as a very similar sort of thing. And I think people don't give drivers enough credit that are in Formula E that how long it takes to master these cars.
I think from what John Rick Vaughan did in season three at Punta del Este was incredible. But it was a completely different formula back then in season one. Cars were spec cars. Yeah. So everyone could have driven. Everyone essentially had the same car. Okay, so Verne had the same material as what Hoping Tung did, or Antonio Garcia may have been at the time, actually, in that race, in the Nextev China racing car. So today, obviously, the cars are a bit more developed. So therefore, you know, HWA coming in, it's like a new Formula One team or a new team coming into any sport. You're not going to be challenging Mercedes and Ferrari or Tech Chicha and BMW because the factory team and Virgin and Audi straight away.
Yeah, I think that's
I don't even expect Mercedes and Porsche to be doing that next year. I think people might be shocked with Mercedes and Porsche coming into sport next season. If they're not challenging at the front, it wouldn't surprise me. It might take them a couple of races or a season. You know, they could be midfield teams.
No, I think that's more than fair. I really do. But we'll move a little bit more onto the race and stop the speculation for a minute, although I did enjoy that. And after the first lap carnage, we saw a top six, I would say, of the two BMWs, the two Virgin cars, D'Ambrosio and Lucas Degrassi, not breaking away from everyone else, but it was starting to look as if those guys were the ones that were really going to fight it out for the win. And it was Bird leading for a few laps, for about, I'm still getting used to the timer, I'm not going to lie. I like the timed races plus one lap, I do like that, but I'm still just adjusting a little bit. But Bird was eventually passed by DaCosta, and then Sims passed him straight away. And then, I suppose, for the mid-phase of the race, we saw a lot of the drivers using attack mode. And this is definitely something I've really been looking forward to talking to you guys about, because after Saudi Arabia, I think a lot of people were disappointed with attack mode. Me included, I'm not going to lie. It had some unique elements, and under the safety car, it looked like a really, I suppose, different sort of strategy the drivers could use, and a good replacement for pit stops. But was it going to translate when it wasn't on a straight? Was it going to translate when it was implemented like it was this weekend and round a corner? And I particularly thought this weekend attack mode helped this race so much. Not that it was a dull race, but I do think if there wasn't an attack mode, it would have really struggled. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how it's going to work for the rest of the season. How do you see it, Tobias?
Oh, absolutely the same. I think in a dairy, the location of the attack mode activation zone, the attack zone as they call it, was a bit clumsy. I mean, putting the attack zone right off the exit, right off the apex, really, off the final corner, heading onto a long straight, well, that's not going to help anyone, is it? And now they've placed it in turn three on the outside line. Much, much better location for the attack zone. And, well, it did help racing because, I mean, you might have lost one position. The time loss was around 0.7 to 1 second for each activation. And, well, that was not too much, but enough maybe to lose a position in the race. And, well, it was the big tactical element we were supposed to be getting in Etteria. So the location was key, And this time things panned out really, really nicely. I really enjoyed the attack mode this time out, as opposed to Aderia, where I agree. In Aderia, attack mode wasn't really, well, the big thing we were promised. It was more of a disappointment. This time out, different story. Completely different story. And it really spiced up the race, in my opinion.
I think it gave it that element, you know, what form, it worked perfectly, because you could use attack mode. Okay, so if you're a bird in that race, for example, who was struggling for pace, okay, and fell back behind, I think, Degrassi in that as well, and then he uses attack mode and repassed Degrassi, and then straight away, okay, you've used your attack mode, you've got past that driver that you were struggling, okay, you've saved your energy, but now you're passed, okay, but now you've got that thing of, now I've got to defend my position because Degrassi's got to use his attack mode. Okay, so then it's not a sure pass. That's what I like about it. It doesn't mean if you use attack mode, you're going to get passed. Okay, you need to use it in a way that you get passed and you stay passed, because there's no point you taking attack mode, overtaking, your attack mode finishes, the person still behind you still got to use their attack mode and they go straight back past you, and again, you gain nothing. So it's using it in the right place at the right time so you can use it and stay ahead when the next person, the person you've just overtaken, has used his attack mode, and then you've technically undertook him, you could say, and got the position. So it can, it really worked well, especially it worked well for the Virgins in that race after their beginning blip. And I think the location was perfect as well, round the outside, because you could see it. It cost them about a second and a half to two, and if you weren't 2 seconds behind, you saw so many just emerging in front of the car behind, because imagine if you took attack mode and fell behind. So there was a lot of elements to just take in and really think about to make attack mode work. So I think it worked superbly.
It was brilliant. It really was. Although, again, fan boost was nowhere. And I don't know if that was because of the attack mode and fan boost went under the radar. And I don't know if that was because some of the boys who had the fan boost were ending up, well, DNFing. But I didn't see fan boost at all. Or at least its, I suppose, usage was just so minor that I can see it leaving at some point. That might be a topic for another day, but I really do think attack mode has added that, I suppose, more unique element and something that they were looking for with fan boost. But I think they've been able to make it into a way that a lot of fans are actually going to like it this time round. But what I will say is, to add on to what you said there, Jack, is that some drivers were holding out for a safety car with one of their attack modes, and that's exactly what happened. With 9 minutes to go in the race, the two leaders, who had made a comfortable gap, the two BMW cars, somewhat collided. I say that in quotation marks because it wasn't a big contact, but the result was that Antonio Felix da Costa from the lead into the barriers, out of the race. Alexander Sims down to fourth place, safety car out, with D'Ambrosio in the lead with the two Virgin cars behind. But the incident itself, I think you can probably tell in how I just described it then, I do think it was very strange. Sims goes for a move around the outside, which I feel he was, well, allowed to do. I think he did nothing wrong in trying to do that. Both of them locked up. Da Costa heavily locked up. They both had that little bit of contact, and like I say, Da Costa ended up in a race where if he had just left Sims go by, Da Costa could have got second place and extended his lead at the top of the championship. A clumsy move, I really do believe that, and I'm sure this is going to be a highly debated one, so I'll let you go first to Bias.
Ooh, well, where do I start? I mean, they of course had this big, big gap to the other four in this group of six at the front. I think it was about around 5 seconds. I was following the timing screens while they were out on track, and I had a colleague of mine sitting right next to me, and he was telling me the gaps, or the lap times more, and well, he told me, well, the two BMWs just lost 0.8 seconds on the last lap, now 1.2 seconds, and now they've done an equal lap, now they've lost 2 seconds, and all of a sudden, well, the other four were right with the BMWs, and I think Alexander Sims just saw the competition come closer in his mirrors, and said, well, I'm going to have to go for the move then. And I mean, the location of him trying to pass Antonio Felix da Costa, maybe he could have picked another spot on the track. of course, turn seven is a really difficult place to overtake. We saw Felix Rosenqvist do that to Sebastian Buemi last year for the race-winning move. But, I mean, you still have... You still need the other driver to cooperate with that. And, in my opinion, Antonio Felix da Costa is to blame for the incident, because he was... I mean, on one hand, it's, of course, his teammate. On the other hand, he just should have known that the car behind might be quicker. He just should have given up earlier, in my opinion. What do you think, Jack?
Yeah, I agree with you in some respect. I agree. The attack mode, again, worked perfectly, because D'Ambrosio, the Virgins behind, they were all closing in because of attack mode. And that made Sims have to think, like, okay, what am I going to do? And obviously he decided to go around at a tight left-hander at turn seven, which, you know, that's what I love about Formula E, and that's what I was saying before the podcast. Every overtake is a brilliant overtake because the walls are so tight. And every overtake you watch and you wince. And you go, oh, he did it. Oh, what a move. And straight away, you're in what a move territory, because, you know, he's done it without the two colliding and they've gone away. But obviously, this case didn't happen. So I think Sims was under pressure because he saw what was coming along. But honestly, I'm not going to portion blame on either side. I think they're both as bad as each other. I think Sims should have waited. Turn seven was, especially against your teammate, was the worst place to maybe go round and have an overtake. I would have waited till turn one, maybe turn three. Someone was a bit more safer. And at least turn one, you had runoff, which Da Costa, if you were to touch, you know, could have easily rejoined and you wouldn't have lost your lead, you know. So, yeah, for me, it was silly. It was shocking. But, you know, that's motorsport and that's why we love it.
That is very true, to be fair. And, I think we all know what an ending it really served up for us. I mean, safety car leading the pack, D'Ambrosio, the two Virgins, then Sims, who I believe still had a fan boost. It was very strange, wasn't it? Because they weren't too sure whether the safety car was coming in on the very last lap or if they were going to finish under safety car. So the majority of the drivers who had a attack mode left decided to use it. Then there was an extra lap under the safety car. So then it was Sims and Degrassi who were both had a attack mode going into the final lap. And, well, we did have that final lap scrappage. And did you guys think that D'Ambrosio was going to be able to hold on?
Just.
Yeah.
I mean, I was crossing my fingers for D'Ambrosio. I mean, not crossing my fingers for anyone, but I felt like D'Ambrosio had it. But I wasn't 100% sure. I was kind of sure that he will fight for it and was hoping that he could get his first race on track race victory. We've got to talk about that in a minute. It looked close in the end, but I think starting with the restart after the safety car, things were not crystal clear, but still kind of clear that D'Ambrosio might have it already.
Yeah, and I think as we also... Did you want to say something there, Jack? Sorry.
No, sorry. Just, you know, I think heart in the mouth moment when D'Ambrosio went wide or sort of locked up going into the last corner and sort of straddled the curb and, you know, that opened up. You could even hear it in Jack Nicholls' voice. Was like, oh, you know, it was just last lap frenzy. I think he managed, though, D'Ambrosio. He did manage the lap fairly well and he was able to come through and, you know, and he drove fantastically, and I think he thoroughly deserved that victory because he was a driver that was so patient during the race. He was, you know, he made his moves, he saved his energy. He was exactly how Dale Baggio described him to me when he was like, he's a driver that can just take the race in and make the moves at the right time. And that's why they signed him, and he did exactly that in Marrakesh. He made his moves to precision, he went up the grid, and he inherited the lead, yes, through the BMW clash, but, you know, you have to put yourself in that position just in case something like that happens, and that's exactly what D'Ambrosio did, so it was thoroughly deserved.
And it was very similar to how he did it in Saudi Arabia, wasn't it? He was just sort of patient, and when it was the right time to strike, he made those moves and got on the podium there, and yeah, as we've just mentioned, he did come across the line and took the victory in Marrakesh, the second year in a row that Mahindra have been able to do it. And it was the two Virgin cars straight behind D'Ambrosio of Robin Frins in P2 and Sam Bird in P3. Thoroughly deserved, like you say, from D'Ambrosio. A little bit surprised, I'm not going to lie. Starting down in P10 with Wehrlein in P7, I didn't think the Mahindras were going to have the pace. But like you say, D'Ambrosio's just ability just to be calm. And I think he's a driver, I think Jack Nicholls said this during the race, he, I suppose, is an underrated driver. But I think, as you were just saying there, Jack, he's not really a flashy driver in the sense that he doesn't make these crazy bold moves. He just sort of gets the job done when he needs to. And that's why he got the race win. And the two Virgin cars, I'm still a little bit surprised that they both got on the podium, because even though their pace in qualifying seems so good, during the race, they just seem to fall back a little bit. But they obviously were fortunate because of the two BMWs. So what I'm going to ask you guys now is, who was your driver of the day? I love doing this. I love doing drivers of the day. And I'm just going to go first. And for me, it is D'Ambrosio, for obvious reasons. I think he really was the smartest driver of all, managed to avoid all the chaos. But I also think both the Tochita boys should be in for a shout. Lotterer are starting way at the back of the grid due to issues on his qualifying run, all the way up into P6, I believe it was, at the end. Correct me if I'm wrong. And obviously, Jean-Éric Vergne, I think, would have been my driver of the day if not for that first lap incident. And Jack, are you on the same wavelengths as me, or is there someone else?
Well, I was going to give it to Vergne, and just to be different, because I knew obviously D'Ambrosio was going to go. So I was like, well, you can't all choose D'Ambrosio, otherwise, you know, it'd be a bit boring. So I thought, yeah, I'll be out there. I'll go for Vergne, and I'll tell you why I go for Vergne. He gained more 10-15 seconds of race time on the BMWs, and to me, it proved that BMW, yeah, they're quick, but they're not the quickest in Formula E. You know, those Tochita boys are. That team is quick, and what they've done at that team has been remarkable. Even, you know, go back to last year, just very quickly, with the Renault powertrain. You know, they won so many races, and Renault didn't win one. And now they've got the DS powertrain. Now, I'm not saying the DS powertrain is bad, but I think what that team's done is, even if they had a mediocre, middle-of-the-range powertrain, because obviously we've got nothing to compare DS to anymore, even though DS did produce good powertrains for Virgin, they were able to take 15 seconds out of BMW in that race without a safety car. And with Vergne. And I thought that was extraordinary. Even though he ruined his race, okay, to come back the way he did was fantastic. So I will go out there, maybe get crucified in the comments, but Vergne.
I honestly think DS has the best powertrain out of all cars. I think, I would say DS has a better car than BMW has.
Yeah, I would agree to that. It's always difficult because you can't compare, because, you know, you could say they have the best powertrain because they're the fastest, okay? But, you know, when we were able to compare Tochita with Renault last year, you know, you could see Tochita were doing a better job with a customer team with their software and how they manage that powertrain. So obviously they can get the best out of a powertrain that maybe not might be race-winning material, because you'd think Renault would have been a team that if Tochita could win, Renault could win, because they should surely know their powertrain more than what the Tochita guys know. They built it.
Well, we've got to talk to Virgin about their Audi powertrain then, don't we? Because they...
Yeah, and it's the exact same process, exact same thing. So that's what I mean. Like, Audi are scratching their heads, but they know it's in there. At the moment, they know the pace is in the car. They've just got to extract it. The Virgin boys have done fantastic because they have extracted it. And they didn't really extract it in Saudi Arabia. It took that test in Saudi Arabia. And then we're like, oh, okay, look, there might be some pace in that Virgin after all. And then they showed it in qualifying. And even, I did a poll on Twitter, and even the fans, they didn't really think Virgin would take pole away from, you know, Audi and Tochita. BMW and Tochita, but they did. So there is pace in the Audi powertrain. It's just Audi have got to extract it.
And the thing is, all these powertrains are homologated already. They have been untouched since August. And
yeah, but it's the software.
Exactly,
the software is where they
the only thing DS, or no, not DS Virgin Racing, Envision Virgin Racing using the Audi powertrain, the only thing that I can do is improve the software. And
yeah, exactly.
That's where they found all.
And that's what Tochita did
exactly,
last season.
Yeah. So software really is an important topic in Formula E. Now, my favourite driver of the day probably is Jerome D'Ambrosio as well. I mean, I get the point of Jean-Éric Vergne. He had a fantastic race fought back from, well, technically last after the Turn 1 incident. But I'd say Jerome D'Ambrosio just for the simple reason that he has been patient for so, so long. He's been waiting to stand on the top step of the podium for the last 4 years. He had a really, really tough and difficult time with Dragon, who obviously were, well, not even mid-pack teams at some stages. And, well, had a difficult time with Dragon, moved teams over the summer, and thoroughly deserves now actually winning a race. I mean, he had two race victories before that. But those were only after or following disqualifications of the original leader. Coincidentally, both times Lucas de Grassi being disqualified for technical infringements, and he then inherited the race victory. And I mean, you could just hear the emotions and how much it meant to him. Yeah. Actually, yeah.
That's what was really
winning
special.
A race on merit.
Amazing, wasn't it?
Yeah. So that's what I think. That's what motor racing is all about, isn't it?
Emotions. Yeah. So here's the thing. Do we all think Mahindra are going to be title contenders just through their pure consistency over the others? Or do we think it's just the opening two races?
Dark horses.
It's possible because it's only a 13-race championship. So consistency is king. If you're consistent and pick up points, you know, look at when Keke Rosberg won his Formula 1 championship. He didn't win a race. So, you know, consistency is king. If they can be consistent, he's already got, I think, so he's got 40 points, so it's like a 12-point lead already.
Yeah.
So, you know, if he carries on finishing fifth and, you know, the top runners muck about a bit, you know, he can be in there. As title contenders, probably not. I don't think Mahindra would expect that. I think Mahindra are going to become probably one of the best of the rest, I think, and as I think they weren't expecting that win. That's why I think that emotion for that win was so strong, because they weren't expecting it. Maybe in season 4 and 3, when they were starting to win, they knew they had the car to do it. Whereas this season, another year of development, more money, I would say, are going into the BMW and maybe the DS powertrains than what Mahindra are putting in. So, you know, as Dilbeck said after the race, you know, take them as they come and enjoy them, because for Mahindra, they might be few and far between, sadly. But they're a very good team and could become the best of the rest, and I wouldn't count them out.
Amen to that.
Nice.
Yeah.
But you like that?
Yeah.
Dilbeck would be happy.
Oh, I agree as well. I think even, I mean, Wöhrlein this weekend's obviously a difficult weekend for him, but looking at his pace throughout the weekend, seemed to be a little bit in front of D'Ambrosio. So if he can continue that throughout the season, I think they've got a really strong lineup there. And I think, like you say, best of the rest, I think, is a fair, I suppose, decision to say. But I think if they can continue, just, I mean, even in Saudi Arabia, I was confident D'Ambrosio wasn't going to get on the podium. So if things go their way, yes, anything can happen in Formula E. I really do believe that. And I'd love to see another world champion. I really would love to see that, whoever it is. That's nothing against any of the former world champions, but I really love that stat that's flying around in Formula E. But I think that's about it. I think we've covered everything. Is there anything you guys want to mention that I've not covered yet?
I don't think so, no. I mean, not to clarify, really, but to show how bloody close Formula E is at the moment. We have four teams pretty much with level points in the constructor standings. DS Techita, 47. BMW and Mahindra, both 40. And Envision Virgin Racing, 36 points. So just 11 points between the first four cars. Then there's a bit of a gap. And then 18, 15, 14 for positions 5 to 7. So it's really, really close in Formula E, and especially in terms of, well, the team's standings. And that's going to be fascinating to follow throughout the season if things stay the same for the next couple of races. I mean, this is...
So maybe, as I said, consistency should be king maybe in this championship this year.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This is going to be a fascinating season to watch. If you didn't watch the previous four years, you should start watching now. Because this is the time to join.
Go back to Formula E's YouTube. go back to Formula E's YouTube and literally just sit down one evening and watch race after race after race after race. And then, you know, then you become one of us.
It's absolutely worth it.
And you'll be fully worth it. Go for it.
Right, well, that's...
better than anything on Netflix.
Well, I think you're probably right, to be fair. Especially some of those... not all of the races. But...
I was going to get shot down. I thought I was going to get shot down on that one. But anyway, we'll move on quickly.
But no, I think that should be it. So, guys, thanks for coming on. Jack, it's been a pleasure.
No, thank you.
And Tobias, it's been great talking to you, man. And I hope to have you both back very soon.
So do I. Thanks very much for having me on.
So that's it then. That's your lot for the very first Formula E Zone podcast of season 5. Next time out is Santiago in Chile, a brand new circuit layout, and it looks completely open for the title in both the Drivers' Championship and the Teams' Championship. If you've got any comments to give, please tweet us over at the Formula E Zone, or you can leave a comment in the comment section below. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next time in Chile.